This is Bob Pittman, and you're listening to Legal Line Online. You can always catch us at bobpittman.com. I'm here with Justice Gary Alexander. Now, I have to say right away, I almost said Chief Justice Gary Alexander, and I don't really feel comfortable saying former Chief Justice Alexander because you're here, but I want to say welcome to you, and I appreciate you taking time to be on our new edition of Legal Line, which is just started up at bobpittman.com.
Well, Bob, it's nice to be here with you. We've been together on the radio a few times in the past, and I've always enjoyed visiting with you, and it's nice to be here with you today.
Well, I appreciate it. And so I guess since I started off with the former Chief Justice, you have to tell us, you were Chief Justice, actually, I believe, the longest time of any Chief Justice in Washington State history, which is kind of fun because you are a historian also, so right. You get to be in the history books that way. But what's happening with the Chief Justice position?
Well, you're right. I was formerly the Chief Justice. I was first elected by the court in to take office as Chief Justice in 2001. I was reelected twice. The term of a Chief Justice is 4 years. But I'm getting close to mandatory retirement, and I made a decision a while back that since I have to leave the court pursuant to a provision in our state constitution in at the end of 2011, December 31st of 2011, it made sense for me personally, and I thought a good transition for the court if I voluntarily stepped down as Chief Justice, spent my last 2 years on the court as an associate justice, and that's what occurred. And in January, my successor, Barbara Madsen, took over as Chief Justice, and Justice Madsen and I are good friends, and I told her I'd be happy to assist her in any way that she wanted, and she's been doing a great job as my successor. But you're right. I am the longest-serving Chief Justice in the state's history with 9 years under my belt in that position, and I'm, as a history buff, I'm sort of proud of that fact.
That's kind of fun, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people would be interested. You know, you look at the U.S. Supreme Court, and I don't know the if you look back at justices who have served, I think a lot of them have served, wouldn't you say, into their certainly 80s and maybe some in their 90s?
Right. There's no provision in the United States Constitution setting a mandatory age of retirement for justices of the Supreme Court. The Washington Constitution, which was adopted about 100 years after the U.S. Constitution, does provide that justices of the Supreme Court and judges of the Superior Court shall retire at the end of the year that they reach 75. I turn 75 next April, so that means I can serve until December 31st of 2011, and I do intend to stay till the very last
day. That's good. I'm glad.
interestingly, that provision was not in the Constitution. It was adopted in 1889. It came in by amendment in 1952.
Oh, really?
And it's my understanding that there was a judge of a Superior Court in a county that I won't name who was really a revered judge. He'd had a very distinguished record before becoming a judge and was an excellent judge, but he went on the bench until he was 94, and he wouldn't retire, and he couldn't lose an election because he was so revered in his community that it was felt that there should be a mandatory retirement age. History has shown that over the United States Supreme Court, where there is no mandatory retirement age, that there have been justices that have stayed longer than they should have and were suffering from some physical disability or perhaps some form of dementia. Even some of the great names on the court had difficulties in life as they became more elderly. And so I think the Washington provision is probably a good thing. If it was 65 or 70, I would say in this day and age, that's too early to require retirement. But I think 75 is probably about right.
I might push it out a tiny bit more, I think. But,
well, and after I retire, I can pro tem.
I was going to ask you if you're able to.
As a judge or a justice on any court in the state, all the way from municipal court up to the Supreme Court, any court that will have me.
So we might
have to come in by invitation.
But no, we're not going to find you doing traffic cases, though, are we?
Well, you never know. I think, sure, I would like to do that. In fact, one of my former law clerks, Sam Meyer, is a district court judge here in Thurston County, and I saw him at, I see him occasionally at Rotary Club meetings, and I told him, I said, you know, I would like to come up and sit on the district court. I said, I would even come up and do your small claims court.
Yeah.
And it'd be fun for me to get back on the trial bench. I served as a trial judge for 11 years.
Right.
So it'd be nice to sort of relive that experience
in
my life.
And, you know, and small claims court, of course, is the, I guess I call it people's court. That's truly people's court.
Right.
There are no lawyers, in
right.
fact, allowed. And so you're dealing with the two litigants.
You're dealing
directly.
It's really Cracker Barrel justice,
yeah.
but it's an important part of our justice system. It is.
It's
court, no lawyers. It's
right.
just the judge listening to the litigants
yeah.
and making a decision. I think a lot of those decisions are based more on equity than law, perhaps, but that's okay.
At some level, that may not be the worst thing in the world, I suppose.
Well, equity, I think, means fairness.
It does. That's
right.
I think,
yeah.
and maybe a little common sense. I'm a proponent of common sense, and I think you are, too. So, some people complain sometimes. I think they say, well, the law doesn't make any sense, and I think it does. There are times when you look at a case, maybe, and you must say, gee.
Well, a lot of times a legal decision might seem unfair in so far as its application to a particular set of facts. Take a statute of limitations. Let's say you've got a 3-year statute of limitations on a civil case, and a person files their case 3 years and 1 day after the statute started running, and people might say, gee, that's awfully unfair for them not to be able to have their case heard.
Right.
But if you think about it in the grand scale, there is a certain need to have finality. And
right.
so the more grand issue is, should we have finality of causes of action?
Yeah.
Even though in an individual case you might say, gee, that seems sort of unfair.
Yeah, so, you can argue that maybe
right.
about the time, whether it's three
right.
years is appropriate, 4 years, whatever it might be, but there should be something.
That's right.
At some point. And even in
say
the,
you can't just
yeah.
sleep on your
right.
rights
and, right.
and if you don't move on them within a certain amount of time, you're going to lose that
sure.
right to bring the lawsuit.
Yeah.
And so I always think of that as an example where in the large looking at it large scale, it makes sense and it's fair, but it might appear
yeah.
to cause
right.
unfairness in an individual
well,
case.
And, of course, you contrast that with the criminal side. And, of course, there are statutes of limitations, too, for most criminal
most,
matters, not things like murder,
right.
kidnapping, and so forth,
right.
the really serious ones. We don't want to have
right.
a limit. And every so often we'll read now, especially with all the new
and there's exceptions
DNA activity.
There's exceptions to those time limits. If somebody
yeah.
is hiding out in a foreign country,
right.
Even though they have a burglary charge that could have been filed against them, that's the statute of limitations isn't going to run on that.
Good point, which makes sense. So there's a certain common sense to that, I think, too.
Sure.
If you think about it.
Sure.
It strikes me.
Right.
But interesting. So now let's, if we could go back for a minute, because when did you decide to become a judge? I mean, did it just pop in your mind one day, or has it always been something that you wanted to do?
Well, when I became a lawyer in 1964, practicing here in Olympia, it wasn't really something I had directly on my radar screen of, but I think it was sort of in the back of my mind, I would say. And when I started practicing law in Thurston County, it was actually a two-county judicial district, Thurston and Mason County. There were two judges that handled all the business in these Superior Court business in these two counties. They added a third judge, and then they finally added a fourth judge, and that would initially go by gubernatorial appointment, and a few people encouraged me to put my name in for appointment, and I did, and Governor Daniel J. Evans appointed me in 1973. And that was the first time I really, when I was approached to consider being a judge, that I really confronted the
yeah.
issue, do I want to be a judge? And I decided I did,
yeah.
and I've never regretted that decision for one moment in the almost 38
yeah.
years that
well,
I've been a judge.
Because now you were appointed to the Superior Court bench then, back then.
Right.
From Governor Evans.
July 16th, 1973, I went on the Superior Court bench. We were still in the old county courthouse that's not too far from
right.
this building where you and I are
here in Thurston County.
Interviewing now at the Temple of Justice, and I served there until, and we moved a few years later into the new courthouse in West Olympia, and I served on that court for 11 years, and then I ran for an open seat on the State Court of Appeals, Division II, which is located in Tacoma, which is the intermediate court between the Superior Court and the Supreme Court, and was elected to that position and served there for 10 years. And then I ran for an open seat on the Supreme Court in 1994 and was elected and came to this court in January of 1995.
So you, when for the Supreme Court, you were not appointed by the governor to the Supreme Court
position.
No,
I wasn't.
You actually ran.
Yeah, of the three courts I've served on, only one of them was did I receive an appointment. That was the Superior Court. Although I will say that about that appointment, I was appointed to take office on July 16th, 1973, and under the law, you have to run to retain that seat at the next election,
which was momentarily.
the primary was in September, so I actually only was an incumbent for about a month and a half when I ran, and I did have opposition, but managed to win in the primary because I got over 50% of the vote against two opponents.
Which is an interesting thing, too. A lot of people don't realize that in the primary, if someone gets in a judicial race, someone gets over
50%. That's right. Judicial races are unique in that if there's only two people running for Superior Court, the election will be decided in the primary because obviously one of them is going to get more than 50% of the vote.
Sure.
If there's more than two people running, you can still be elected in the primary if you get over 50% of the vote against your two opponents or four opponents or three or whatever.
Well, and in fact, in there is a one still contested Supreme Court race, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, as we speak, we have an election coming up in November, and one of our justices, Richard Sanders, has an opponent.
Right.
In the primary, there were three running, and he didn't get quite 50% of the vote, so that puts him into the general. With a nine-member court, the Washington Supreme Court has nine members, and every 2 years, three members of the court have to stand for election.
Right.
This year, our Chief Justice, Barbara Madsen, was on the ballot, and she did not have an opponent, so her name goes on the ballot alone in the general. James Johnson had an opponent in the primary, but he got
more than
50% of the vote, so his name goes on the ballot alone. So of the three justices, Richard Sanders is the only one who's on the ballot this November.
Well, and we have we are unique in a way, and especially if you contrast us to the federal system, federal judicial positions are appointed and by the president.
That's right.
And confirmed by the Senate.
That's right. And it's a lifetime appointment. And
there's no age 75 mandatory retirement.
In the early history of our country, it was not as such an ordeal to obtain one of these appointments as it is now, because this confirmation by the Senate in recent years has become quite grueling for some of the appointees of the president, and I've watched those on television and thought, give me an election. I think it's an easier process almost than going through the very serious and questioning that they get from the senators.
Well, and of course we don't hear as much about maybe the district court positions. It strikes me, extremely political. I guess everything in life is maybe, but very good candidates, obviously, for the court, being left hanging, if you will, and sometimes not being confirmed.
Yeah, there isn't as much attention focused on the appointment of the justice in the federal system below the Supreme Court, the district, United States District Court judges, or the United States Court of Appeals. We're in the Ninth Circuit of the United States Court of Appeals, and those judges don't get at least the public scrutiny that appointees to the U.S. Supreme Court do. But there is a good deal of scrutiny that goes on really unknown to the public.
We don't read about it maybe as much, but certainly a tremendous scrutiny going on. Very different than here in Washington, where our judges are elected all the way from the top to the bottom, I don't know what the lowest position would be.
Every judge in Washington is elected, except there is one exception, municipal court judges who are part-time. So small cities that have part-time municipal court judges, they are appointed by this city, the mayor or the city council. But full-time municipal court judges are elected. But other than that, district court judges, superior court judges, court of appeals judges, Supreme Court, all elected by the public. 4-year terms for trial judges, 6-year terms for appellate court judges.
While we're on trial judges, there are people who would argue there's a very different role. Appellate court judge versus a trial judge. I mean, if you could tell us the difference between them that you think.
Well, it is. It's a different art form, if you will. A trial judge is on the bench pretty much all day, every day, ruling on the variety of cases that come before him or her. Let's talk about the Superior Court. That's the court of general jurisdiction. A Superior Court judge in a smaller county can one day be hearing a criminal case, the next day a accident case, or something to do with a probate. The whole variety of legal issues that come to court. But that judge must make a decision by himself or by herself, applying the facts, which can be determined by a jury, but most trials are bench trials, applying the law as the judge knows it to the facts of a particular case. In the appellate court, the decision making is a collective enterprise. On the state court of appeals, judges sit in panels of three, so the three of those judges are going to have to review a trial that was held in a trial court and determine if it was a fair trial, and are going to have to render a written opinion, and there may be disagreement among the three judges as to how that case should come out. At the Supreme Court, it's a larger body of people that are making this collective decision. It's a 9-member
court. It's hard to get a unanimous
decision. It's harder to get unanimous. The more people you get, the more possibility there is for disagreement. And it is a different process. It's necessary for the proper functioning of an appellate court, for the judges to be collegial. That doesn't mean they have to agree on everything. They won't agree on everything and shouldn't. People should call a case the way they see it. But they have to, it's important that they get along and can disagree with each other without being disagreeable.
Makes sense. And very deliberative process.
Very deliberative.
As opposed to a trial court judge where I imagine you think back on your own career as a trial court judge, you had to make decisions right then and there.
Right. An appellate court, I mentioned that a trial judge is pretty much on the bench all day, every day, whereas in an appellate court, we're in our chambers more than we're on the bench. During a term of court, we hear cases on Tuesdays and Thursdays. At the Supreme Court, we hear 4 cases a day. And so more of our time is spent preparing for those hearings, reading the briefs, which are the written arguments of the counsel. When we're in the courtroom, we're hearing their oral argument. We're reviewing cases that have been cited. And then once we've made a decision as a court, we have to write a decision. The state constitution says that the court must issue an opinion with reasons given for the decision. And those decisions become part of the common law of the state. And so it's very important not only what the result is, but how we define the law is pertinent to the case. So it's very important that we really be careful on how we write these decisions.
Absolutely.
So that takes time, and writing can be difficult.
Well, yeah,
about everyone, and it's hard work.
Yeah, but you have a lot of time that goes into a case. When we see, and I would sure encourage everybody to go look, they're readily available now. It used to be a little bit of a pain to get copies of cases. You had to go to a law library usually. But now you can actually go online and pick them up, and we'll post information as to how people can do that too. It's very easy now. But when you read that, I mean, you have to think, I mean, you've spent hours and hours and hours thinking through the matter and then developing the opinion, writing it. One of you is writing, one of you writes the majority opinion.
Right. And it's important how we say what the law is, because decisions of an appellate court are precedential and they're binding on trial courts. So in other words, they have to follow a decision of the appellate court, whether they like it or not. And so when a similar case comes before a trial judge, an attorney can say, well, the Supreme Court has decided in Jones versus Smith or thus and so, and the trial judge must follow that decision if he or she concludes that it's pertinent to that particular case. So,
and if they go against it, typically
on the availability of the decisions, the decisions of the Supreme Court have always been transparent in the sense that they're in book form and they're in the lawyers' offices and in the law libraries in each county in our state law library. But not everybody, most citizens don't go into a law library very often. Now, a citizen or an attorney or the press can access our cases by online immediately the opinion is filed.
And you can sign up to be alerted the moment they basically come out. I get alerts during the week for various appellate courts. And
I remember it used to be, for instance, if a lawyer had a case in the Supreme Court, and they would get a call from the Supreme Court saying the opinion's been filed. And, of course, the attorney would ask, how did I do? Well, they'd say the court affirmed or reversed. And that was about it. And then a few days later, the attorney would get a copy of the opinion in the mail. Now we actually call them the day before the opinion's issued and say, your opinion may be filed in your case tomorrow. So that morning, Thursday is our filing day each week, the attorney just gets online and they can see it, the opinion. Used to be that the members of the press used to come here to the Supreme Court and line up and get copies of the opinions. They don't have to come to the building anymore because they can go online as well. And miss that. I always liked seeing the the members of the press lined up to get copies of the opinion. But
we've lost some of our little ceremonies, I guess, in life, I think, in
general. The U.S. Supreme Court, interestingly, they've still maintained the ceremonial aspect of actually having the opinions read on Opinion Day. And I don't think people can actually get a copy of it until it's actually been read in the court. I think that's kind of a nice tradition. We've talked about that, but we actually decide quite a few more cases in a year than the U.S. Supreme Court.
How many do you suppose come out now of the Supreme Court?
Well, we try to issue about 135 opinions a year. The U.S. Supreme Court's been doing around 75 or 80, we're not quite double their production, but pretty close to it. And so
some would say you're working harder than the
I wouldn't be so bold as to say that, but I think we're working pretty hard.
I think so, too.
I'm sure they think they're working hard, too. We don't read the opinions. We file them.
Now, this is, we're all thinking, this is really important stuff, if you will, that affects our everyday lives from the Superior Court or District Court level, Court of Appeals, Supreme Court, daily lives here in Washington for many people. Sometimes they don't realize that cases affect it, but they do. And we're electing the people who are making those decisions, which a lot of us think is pretty important. I mean, I'll state my bias. I tend to be a proponent of the idea of electing judges, and not that you can't have a good argument on the other side.
Sure.
But very important, and so that means that we need to take it seriously, too, when we're voting. And I think we need to guard that right rather jealously, and it's and been under attack a number of times over the years, where people believe that we should stop electing our judges as we do.
I think it's very important that our citizens take time to look into these judicial races so that they can make their vote an intelligent one. And it's I will have to say it's a little bit more difficult sometimes to find out information about judicial candidates. And we've endeavored in the justice system to try to get more information out there. There are voters' pamphlets. There's an electronic voters' pamphlet on TVW television for Washington. There are various groups making endorsements. There's endorsements by newspapers and other media outlets. So there is information out there, but it is a little more difficult for people to find out about it. And people also do not have the partisan tag to rely on.
Right.
Some person might be a rock-ribbed Democrat or a rock-ribbed Republican, and that may influence their vote. But judges run on a nonpartisan basis, which is appropriate, I think.
I think so.
But
yeah.
So the voter doesn't have the aid of a partisan tag, which is helpful to some voters in partisan elections. So, but I really urge people to take the time to try to find out about the judges. Well, and judicial candidates so they can make their vote count.
And I think if you go to the forums where judicial candidates are in attendance, I mean, a lot in terms of getting out to the public, you can ask them questions.
That's
now, if they can't answer, they'll tell you. But you can ask questions.
And, you know,
I
often hear people say, well, you know, the judges can't tell you anything. And, you know, and I've been a judge for 38 years, and I honestly don't think I've ever said, oh, I'm sorry, I can't answer your question. I think the judges, they may not be able to answer it in terms of telling you how they will decide certain types of cases in the future, but they might be able to indicate to you what they believe the law is in general on this subject.
And that tells you something about the candidate,
right,
too, I think.
Right. For instance, I think the hot-button issues over the years have been abortion, death penalty, and death penalty. And if nothing else, the judge can tell you what they believe the state of the law is regarding the death penalty or rights to abortion or whatever. And so they can give some sort of an answer that will, I think, be helpful to the voter.
Well, I think if you go to see the person at one of these candidate forums, you also can see them and hear them speak and how they respond to questions. That tells you a little something about an individual, too, I believe.
Right.
And so you can do a job of trying to figure out who you ought to be voting for, and it's so important. I mean, even if I'll call it a fun case, but even a case, go back to the Safeco Field. there's something that affects an awful lot of people.
That's right. And we had a divided court. I wrote the opinion for the court upholding the funding mechanism that the legislature passed for building a Safeco Field. Justice Sanders wrote a strong dissent, and he and I had different views on the issues related to that particular case, but it's an important one, whether you're a baseball fan or not. It was an expenditure of a lot of public money.
Yeah, you can argue it affects everybody in the state.
Or one case where we had, I think, the largest attendance we've ever had at a hearing here was we actually had overflow crowds over at the legislative building watching us on television and over at the United Churches across the street. And that was the so-called gay marriage case, the case that had to do with the constitutionality of Washington's Defense of Marriage Act. And again, these are issues that affect a lot of people.
They do.
And even those who don't have aren't directly affected are interested in the subject.
I think so. And the people deciding are people we've elected as judges. And I think it's just, I mean, we need to connect up, and I wish.
And that's a case, that latter case I talked about, that's a case where the two branches of government really were involved. We were being asked to declare a statute that was passed by the legislature saying marriage is between a man and a woman, and whether that was unconstitutional. So we were really being asked to judge the work of another branch of the government. And in that particular case, we upheld the statute against the challenge, but it was a 5-4 decision. Yeah. The court was very much split, but I can tell you that the discussions we had in the conference afterward were carried on in a very civilized and polite manner.
But see, when you look at 5-4 decisions, I mean, your vote did count. Because if you had voted, the public, had voted someone else in, it's possible it could have been 5-4 the other way.
That's right.
You don't know.
That's right. I think this, the matter of something I've thought a lot about over my years as a judge is the election versus the appointed system. And I really feel very strongly that the election of judges is fits the legal culture of the state of Washington. Washington, the state of Washington, throughout its entire history, has wanted its public officials, including judges, accountable to the public by periodic election. And as you know, we elect just about everybody in Washington. We elect, we have a divided executive. We elect the governor, but we also elect the lieutenant governor, the secretary of state, the treasurer, the auditor, and attorney general, and
they don't always agree with each other.
That's right. And we have a variety of taxing districts around this state, school district, port districts, diking districts, hospital districts, cemetery districts, and each of them has a board of commissioners, and we elect them. And I don't sense any groundswell of support in this state for amending the Constitution to provide that these offices be appointive rather than elective. I just don't think it may fit the cultural traditions of another state, but it doesn't really seem to fit with Washington.
Every so often it'll come up, though, and there was a commission even several years ago, and they were trying very hard to get into a system where there would initially be an appointment, if I remember right. Is that correct, an appointment, and then some kind of retention election?
Yeah, I think the proposal was that there be a commission which would send names to the governor, and the governor would have to appoint from that list, and that person would serve a period of time, I've forgotten exactly, and then they would stand for election, but not against a flesh and blood opponent, but rather on the record, yes or no, I want Judge Smith to stay in office. And that really isn't much of an election, and I think the history of those elections in those states that have such a system is that it's just about everyone gets a pass.
But even if they don't, there's just someone else appointed, I assume.
That's right. And I always wonder, who elects the electors? Who decides who makes the appointment? And, of course, the proponents of this will tell you, well, it'll be a broad-based group. But who picks the broad-based group? These so-called blue ribbon committees sometimes can be, in my view, can become a bit elitist.
Sure. And we make mistakes, obviously, as voters. But also, you can look at this very court over the decades, and I think we could identify quite a few people who would not have been, or not likely to have been, selected by that kind of a commission, and yet they've made wonderful judges and done a great job.
They can bring a point of view that might not pass muster with a blue ribbon committee. If you want a judiciary, particularly an appellate court, which is a multi-judge court, if you want a variety of views, I think the elective system is more calculated to give you that than would blue ribbon committee sitting in a office building in Seattle making this decision for you.
Again, I'll state my bias. I mean, so there's no, but I think that is important, and I think it's important that we all think about it as voters and keep a watchful eye on the system, because there are times when someone will try to slip one by us. In the system, and we want to be active, and that's one concern. You talk about civics And everybody, you know, sometimes people say, oh, they yawn or something. Oh, yeah, civics, I guess we have, you know. But civics to me is a very exciting, we should maybe come up with a different word for it. I don't know, a word more in tune with an iPod or iPhone or something. But.
Well, another thing should be said about the election versus appointment. Our state constitution provided the judges, with the exception of municipal court judges that I talked about earlier, are to be elected. And so it would require a constitutional amendment. That means you'd have to get a vote, two-thirds vote at each house to put a constitutional amendment to the public. Then the public would have to vote it. And I don't sense any groundswell of support for in the legislature for putting it to the people or the people voting it if it was put to them. Some people might grouse about the courts or individual judges or anything, but I think when it gets into the ballot box, I think that's a right, the right to elect its judges that people are not going to give up
easily. I hope not. And I think we'll keep talking about it and maybe that'll help.
It might, you know, what might bring it about someday, if there was a great scandal within the justice system and came out that there was corruption in the system.
Corruption,
widespread corruption. It might happen, but I know this sounds awfully self-serving, but I think our elected judiciary since 1889 has served this state well. There's never been any corruption in any scale at all in this state, and so I think people, I think, are generally fairly satisfied with the system that they have.
I think so. I think every once in a great while you might find something that some judge may have done, and yet the system roots them out, if you will.
It roots them out by election. And there's another way that judges can be removed, and that we do have a judicial conduct commission. If a judge acts in an unethical way, a party can make a complaint against them, and the charges can be brought, and they can be removed by order of the Supreme Court before their term is actually up. So,
and that is not a commonplace event, but it has happened.
Or it may be, if a judge is convicted of a crime, that judge, and there was a fairly recent example of this, where the judge actually resigned after a conviction. Mm-hmm. So, the system, I think, has the ability to flush out people that need to be flushed out.
I think so. Makes me think of jury too. By the way, I citizens volunteering, if you will, to be in the jury system. Obviously, you don't totally volunteer, but that is something that's changed during your term, in your term as Chief Justice, to some extent. Can you tell us a little bit about?
Well, I don't know. It really hasn't changed. I did want to get one change that I was never able to get. During all 9 years I was Chief Justice, I prevailed upon the state legislature to increase the daily attendance fee for jurors, which in Washington, which I think is an embarrassing amount of money. It's $10 a day. It was set in 1959, I believe. And in case anyone has noticed, we've had a bit of inflation since 1959.
Just a little bit, yeah.
I told somebody I was a second lieutenant in the Army just out of college and making $222 a month and had a quarter's allowance and a ration allowance. It came to less than $400 a month total, and I thought I was doing pretty well.
Yeah.
And you could live on that, and I was married. But right now, $10 a day, you're almost taxing people to serve as a juror because – in a metropolitan area, to get a parking place downtown, if they have to pay for it, they're going to pay more than that.
More than that.
They have to buy lunch. If they have children at home, they may have to get child care. Yeah. And we tried to get a bill through the legislature that increased the fee to something akin to the minimum wage. So you'd get the same amount of money that you would get if you were working at McDonald's or someplace, which seemed to me to be reasonable, plus mileage, which they do get now. And I thought for a while we were going to get somewhere with it, but with this recent economic downturn, it just...
So it remains at the
$10. And I think it's a sad commentary that we haven't. So I'm hoping that my successors here at the Supreme Court will keep pitching for that change. But
there has been a shortening of the time that, that you need to serve, though, hasn't there?
Yes. That's been one good change during my time as a lawyer and as a judge, is the amount of time that that jurors are expected to serve has been reduced. And also, by they've come up in the court system with methods by which you can avoid just bringing people to the courthouse and then having them find out that the case is settled and they're not needed. Most of the counties, if not all of them, have the jurors call in a particular number, and we'll say jurors 1 through 20 need not appear today. That's been good for juror convenience and also for the public purse.
Right, but we want people then to not try to get out of jury duty as much.
And in other words, there have been a lot of efforts to make serving as a juror much more palatable. A lot of emphasis placed on giving jurors a good orientation when they first come, so they know just what's expected of them. So I really encourage anybody in the listening audience to, if your number comes up and you're called for jury duty, please do it. I think you'll find it a valuable experience. And it's so important. I talking about juries, I almost want to hear the Star Spangled Banner playing in the back, because it's a right that we have in the United States that's not shared by most people in the world. We inherited the right to trial by jury idea from our English forebears, although, as I understand it, in England they really don't use the jury system very much anymore, and we're really the last bastion in the world of the, and it's really a check against the abuse of power by the government. The fact that individuals, ordinary citizens, can go in and judge whether or not a person is guilty of a crime is a valuable and important right in our system.
We shouldn't underestimate that.
And jurors also sit on civil cases and determine liability in tort cases, for example, accident cases, and determine the amount of compensation people should get in those kinds of cases, and in condemnation cases, eminent domain cases. And that's an important right that we as American citizens have to sit in judgment of the facts of the case of another citizen. Yeah. And so,
well, makes sense.
So we want to preserve the right to trial by jury.
And keep an eye on our ability to elect judges and get involved.
Right.
Get involved a little bit more. Just, you know, try going to a candidate forum, a judicial, and ask a question.
Absolutely.
And see what happens.
Yeah.
You might, I mean, you really might like it.
Yeah.
So, it might be scary to the judicial candidates. They actually have people show up at,
but well, no, people do come.
I'll
to
bet
these.
They do.
And I've been to some where we've had pretty big crowds, and it's a good exercise. I think it's important for the judges, in the case of appellate judges, once every 6 years to have to get out there and meet people. And it's a reminder to us that when we're hearing cases, this is not a hypothetical case. We're not talking about X and Y or Blackacre, as we used to refer to property in law school. We're talking about real people. And if nothing else, it causes us to be careful and that we're doing the right thing, because we are really dealing with real people's issues and issues that are important to them and important to the general public. So I think the elective process, even though it's hard work campaigning, and if you're running for the Supreme Court, it's a statewide election. This is a big state when you have to drive around and...
Well, I know with your history background, before the state became a state, they didn't drive around, of course. They actually, judges rode around.
That's right. We were a territory from 1853 to 1889, the territory of Washington, a federal territory. Those judges were appointed by the President of the United States. And actually, initially, for 10 years, the Washington Territory was quite a lot larger than the present state of Washington. It ran all the way east to the Continental Divide. And so, and there were only like 4,000 settlers in the territory when it was created. So think of the judge who was assigned to the eastern division of the territory,
yeah.
sitting in Walla Walla. There were, you know, there weren't roads, and no, the railroad didn't come out here till the 1870s. And I think the telegraph got out here in 1864. But this was a difficult place to get around.
I'll bet. And they
it was easier if you were on Puget Sound because you could get around by boat. But
they actually rode horseback.
And they rode horseback or a stagecoach or whatever they had.
Yeah.
And it was
no navigation systems at that time other than the stars, I guess, and hopefully the road is cut.
And there were three judicial districts, and they sat as a trial judge 11 months of the year. And then those three district court judges, they called them, would get together in Olympia in December of each year and sit as the Supreme Court of the territory and sit in review of cases they had decided
as
trial judges. And I said, well, that's the dream of every trial judge, to be able to review your own decisions.
Yeah, I'll be reviewing my decision later this year.
But they got around that in 1884. They created a fourth position which allowed the judge whose case was being reviewed to not be seated on the Supreme Court in review of his own decision. But
well, we'll have to we'll do a segment in the future maybe about something.
Do you know, this goes back to my interest in history. When the Constitutional Convention met in 1880, one of the reasons I think that they wanted an elected judiciary was that even though the territorial judges were by and large pretty good people that the president has appointed, our presidents of both parties really made those appointments without much deference to the local citizenry and often brought these judges in from back east to sit as a judge of the Washington Territory. And that didn't go down well with the people here. They wanted their own lawyers and lower court judges to be the district court judges. So I think that added fuel to the fire when they had the Constitutional Convention that we want to elect our own judges. And it's a requirement to be a judge in Washington. You have to be a member of the bar of the state of Washington. So,
which makes sense.
Right, yeah. So I think that added to it. And then just the general populist feelings that were very prevalent in the western United States at that time.
Yeah. Well, as we... I know we have to let you do other things, a little judging maybe today, I suppose. but let me ask you, as you look back on the years, you know, maybe all of them, but especially in the Supreme Court, is there something that you would change if you could, if I could hand you like a magic wand or a special gavel that you could change that you'd like to see changed about how we do things, whether it's the Supreme Court or not?
Well, one thing that needs to be changed, and we did make some progress on this in the last decade, is it doesn't so much relate to the two levels of appellate court, the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals, but the way in which we fund our trial courts, our superior courts, our district courts, and our municipal courts needs to be modified. This is really a state court system. It flows from our state constitution. The legislature determines the number of superior court judges, the number of district court judges, and they make the laws. And yet, since our founding, the obligation to pay for these trial courts has been put on the local government, our counties and our cities. And the state pays very little of the cost of our trial courts. They pay one half of the salary of superior court judges and a few other odds and ends, and that's about it. The rest of it is the obligation of our counties and our cities. And the counties and cities can only impose those taxes which the state legislature allows them to impose. And it's been very difficult for our local governments to support our trial courts in an amount that will allow them to adequately do their job. So we, a few years ago, started a Justice in Jeopardy initiative to try to move toward a system where the state government and local government would share the responsibility. Eventually, we were hoping on a 50-50 basis, because we still think it's important that local government have a hand in supporting its trial courts that are located generally in the county courthouse. And we started making some progress in that area and started moving toward that 50% thing, but we didn't get to where we wanted to go. And, of course, with this recent economic downturn, it's our Justice in Jeopardy initiative, as we call it, has kind of come to a screeching halt. And we're hoping that when the economy improves, and I am a Pollyanna, I think it will improve someday, that we can get back and try to get a better system for funding our state trial courts. So if I was a genie and could get that, some sort of improvement, that would be the one I would choose.
Very good. Well, we'll keep it on the list and see if we can promote that in the future.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've been talking with Justice Gary Alexander of the Washington State Supreme Court. I hate to use the word former, but former Chief Justice Gary Alexander voluntarily departed.
Former Chief Justice and current Justice.
I know, that's right. Just sounds funny when I say that. Do people still refer to you as the Chief? I suspect people
I show people call me once in a while. They'll slip around the building here and call me Chief.
Hard.
Even my successor once in a while, Barbara Manson, has called me Chief.
Yeah,
and I have
hard.
To say, no, you're the Chief.
That's right. No, you're the Chief. We could do a little Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, you know, after 9 years, they sort of people sort of had trouble coming up with a new title for me.
Oh, that's great. Well, we appreciate very much your taking time today. And as you know, this will become a podcast or Bobcast, as some of us are rearranged, and it'll be available at bobpittman.com more or less indefinitely. We're creating a searchable archive where
Great.
Someone can next year go on and say, gee, didn't Justice Alexander talk about this or something, and then they'll be able to look and find the interview and actually listen. It's kind of an exciting new development in the area of radio online.
Well, I'm pleased to be a part of this exciting new development.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you very much for taking time, and we'll look forward to talking to you again before you end your term.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bob Pittman for Legal Line.